Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week, the founder of Microsoft and billionaire philanthropist Bill Gates came to Ottawa to discuss child, newborn, and maternal health with Prime Minister Stephen Harper. McLean's was one of the only media outlets to sit down for a one-on-one with Gates. And Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes joins us to play excerpts from his interview.
The government's new anti-terror bill will soon be studied at committee, but only after a fierce debate and a filibuster over how long the review should last. The Parliamentary Secretary to Public Safety, Roxanne James, joins us to discuss the bill and the committee's work.
Ontario's new sex ed curriculum has created quite a controversy. Some parents aren't too pleased with what their kids are going to be taught and how early they'll be learning it. The province's Minister of Education, Liz Sandals, is here to defend her new policy.
And the McLean's panel discusses the committee bickering on the anti-terror bill and why Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is suddenly the underdog.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill.
We set ambitious goals, but our goals are always not so ambitious that they're unachievable. That we set ambitious, achievable goals, and then we go out and actually achieve them.
That's Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who met this week with billionaire philanthropist and computer pioneer Bill Gates.
Gates came to Ottawa to discuss aid to the developing world, a cause he has championed for 15 years through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Prime Minister has also focused on foreign aid in recent years, specifically maternal, newborn, and child health. At an event with Gates, Harper announced new funding for the eradication of polio and for vaccines to prevent tetanus. While Gates was in town, he only did two interviews, and one of them was with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Their chat will be featured in next week's issue of McLean's.
So we've got some highlights from that interview, and John is with us now to talk a bit about them. So John, first of all, before we get to the clips, what was it like sitting down with someone like Bill Gates?
It's interesting, you know, when you get in, they were quite careful, his people. He's got a very slick kind of communications operation, as you would expect for a guy like that. The photographer I was working with and I came into the room after he was already sitting down. And it's something funny about seeing a guy who's such an iconic presence just sitting there in a chair in front of you. There is something about that. He was very focused. He went right into, you know, answers that were pretty content rich. And it was interesting that he was as animated as he was. Actually, one of his people had said, you know, he's pretty laid back. He's very reserved. He didn't seem that reserved when we talked to him. He was gesturing a lot. He was quite into the conversation.
So not quite what you expected or the stereotype I think a lot of people have of Bill Gates in their minds.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly what I expected. I thought he would be just slightly more, not withdrawn, but just a little bit more less into it the moment than he seemed to be. He seemed very enthusiastic and very energized in talking about all this international development stuff that he's been working on now for about 15 years.
All right, so let's get to this interview now. What should we know about this first clip?
He started off by kind of framing the broad goals that he sees and kind of the moment as he sees it. And part of what he thinks is that there's been a lot of progress, serious progress in the developing world, especially Africa, but that Canadians and other people in rich countries just don't understand that. So why don't we give it a listen?
The goals are pretty achievable because of the progress, and yet the visibility of this arc of progress, you know, the grand statistics of what's happening with health or literacy or nutrition, there isn't a broad awareness of those things because people mostly see the bad news. They certainly saw the Ebola epidemic. If there's a famine, if there's an earthquake, they see the negative human condition. The fact that there used to be so many widespread deaths sort of one at a time, that's not a headline. So the drastic reduction, cutting childhood death in half since 1990,
which is remarkable.
Yeah, it should, of all the statistics of, hey, is humanity treating humanity well? Do we feel good about where we are? That one should be pretty top of mind, and yet it's a very small group that would even know that.
So that's interesting, John. He doesn't think that we grasp how much progress is actually being made on this.
Right. No, but what you'll hear that's exactly right. But what you hear in this next clip is, in a way, his kind of what he imagines as the solution to that. It's Gates talking about how he thinks people can become more connected to international development. He talks about, it's very optimistic, he talks about the idea that this could be the year that goes from being a concern just for people who are directly involved to being more like a popular movement.
Well, in countries like the US and Canada, where a lot of people are doing quite well, this question of Can you take your loyalty and your sense of values and go further than just yourself and your family, or even beyond your region and your country? Can you have, you know, as a member of the human race, the idea that you volunteer time or your voice or whatever means you have to give, that you're connecting yourself with these improvements, eradicating polio, for example, or, you know, making sure that there's enough food for poor children? I think that that moral vacuum where people want to be associated with more than just their own success, they want to have knowledge and have a sense of progress that they contributed to, I think that's pretty gigantic. But I will admit that connecting people, because this stuff is far away, fairly complicated, you know, sometimes the money goes through complex groups that you don't understand if they do what they say they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
The question is, in a digital world where you can track things and connect people up and get more evidence back to them at very low cost, can we ignite this basic desire for that connection? And we call that our global citizen movement. In the annual letter, we call for people to kind of connect up digitally.
All right, so John, then you moved on to Canadian aid spending.
Right. I mean, he was in Ottawa for meetings with Canadian politicians, including the Prime Minister. So not surprisingly, he had a kind of an upbeat message about Canada's contribution. Why don't we just listen and hear what the way he put that?
Yeah, during this 15-year period we talked about, 2000-2015, the whole face of foreign aid has changed quite a bit. And if you go back to sort of the Cold War era, it was mostly you gave to friends and you pretended that it was going to have some great humanitarian benefit, but largely it was to cement friendships and sort of the Soviet versus West type paradigm. During that period, this idea of no, you know, let's really shift the money into the things that are impactful, that's caught on quite a bit. And I'd say that Canadian aid helped a lot by civil society voices here, people like Rotary on polio eradication, Save the Children, people who support UNICEF. Canada's actually been at the forefront of a fairly dramatic shift. And so the Canada and the Gates Foundation have been on a similar journey, and it's a mix of both talking to each other and sharing what we're learning, but also seeing the same things. And so the alignment of a substantial part of the Canadian aid budget with the things we're doing is very high.
So, John, that sounds like something Prime Minister Stephen Harper really would like to hear.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, it was just about the highest level endorsement you could imagine for the, you know, his government's approach. And that was what the day was about to a large degree. This was to showcase this sort of partnership or cooperation going on between the Gates Foundation and the Canadian government on a number of levels, and especially maternal and child health, which is, as many people will know, the sort of signature aid goal of the Prime Minister. But, you know, it's funny, as I spoke with Gates, there was something kind of nagging at me, and that was that I think for a lot of Canadians, if you ask them to step back and say, you know, what's the solution to development problems in Africa and elsewhere in the poor world, they would say proper governments that can really deliver programs, free markets that actually work, an end to corruption, all those sorts of fundamental things, which makes you wonder, like, where does a billionaire philanthropist, even one as, in, you know, as influential as Gates, where does he really fit in this picture? And I asked him that question, and, you know, this clip, I think, is him really framing it in an interesting way, in a surprisingly modest way.
Yeah, there's really three sectors of society. There's the private sector, which anything it works for, like, you know, how many Thai restaurants should we have, what toys should be built, you know, this private sector is way, way the best. Then there's things the private sector can do, make sure every kid gets educated, help out people with health emergencies, those things the government should do. And that's, you know, 96-97% of the economy are those two sectors. So what is philanthropy about? When new approaches, say to run a school or a medical research program that has a high risk of failure, or really going and looking at are these African governments doing their job well and have a credible voice that says, no, they should spread best practices. There's a lot of things that those two don't catch. And because philanthropy is so much smaller, It has to pick the things the other two are not appropriate for. It can't be the thing that guarantees every kid gets an education. There's just not enough money and not enough consistency and year in and year out capacity for that kind of thing.
Well, that's really interesting stuff, John. I'm looking forward to reading the full interview.
Yeah, it'll be in next week's issue of McLean's, the print issue, and eventually up online. And we're also going to put up the full audio interview. It's about 15 or 20 minutes with Gates on McLean's.ca. People could watch for that also next week on the website.
Thank you very much, John.
Great to be here. Thanks, Cormac.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes playing us clips from his one-on-one interview with Bill Gates.
Coming up on the show, the battle continues over the Harper government's new anti-terror bill. Why sex has created a big controversy in Ontario, and we'll bring you the McLean's panel.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we have Ontario's Education Minister here to talk about the controversy surrounding the province's new sexual education curriculum, and the McLean's panel talks about Liberal leader Justin Trudeau becoming an underdog. But first,
the controversy continues over the Harper government's new anti-terror legislation. This time, the battle was in committee. The bill has upset the opposition, partially due to the fact that the powers of our police forces and spy agencies are being expanded with little additional oversight. When the committee met to discuss its agenda for reviewing this bill, the NDP filibustered because it was unhappy with the time being reserved to study it. The Conservatives originally suggested just 3 meetings, as the New Democrats called for 25 meetings with 100 witnesses. The government side later increased their offer to 8 meetings with 48 witnesses, which was then adopted as the agenda. During the debate, New Democrat Randall Garrison wasn't happy with the government's plan.
We're not asking for delay. We're asking to do more work on this bill. So we're prepared, as we've said repeatedly, to sit at night, to sit during the next break week. We could easily do 25 meetings before their deadline if we actually get down and work very hard in this committee. When the parliamentary secretary says this means that there will be 50 witnesses, yes, that means in the division of witnesses, the official opposition would get 16. And we have more than 60 people that are experts and provide important information on this bill who would like to appear. So at the current level, it's not acceptable to us. It's not a full study. And there's absolutely no reason for the government to continue to insist that we limit debate on this bill.
Now, the NDP has a potential witness list that includes former Supreme Court justices, legal experts, and 4 former prime ministers, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, John Turner, and Joe Clark. To talk more about the study of the new anti-terror legislation, I'm joined now on the phone by the Parliamentary Secretary to Public Safety, Roxanne James. Why do you think 8 meetings is enough to study a complex bill with such serious implications?
Well, first of all, those 8 meetings will be held throughout the course of several weeks, including in the evenings. We are going to actually be hearing from 48 expert witnesses, in addition to a separate meeting where the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness and the Minister of Justice, along with various officials, will be on hand to answer questions as well. This is more than enough to study this bill. We believe, and I think Canadians believe, that the legislation is essential to national security, to the protection of Canadians here on our soil, and we need to see these measures get passed.
But what's wrong with more meetings? I mean, your government has said that this is a very important bill, as you just talked about, and if that's the case, why not have some more meetings? The NDP proposal is within the deadline that the government is calling for.
Look, we're talking about an opposition party that is fundamentally opposed to this bill. The NDP has not supported a single measure that the Conservatives have brought forward to combat terrorism. They are fundamentally opposed to revoking passports for those that are going to travel overseas. They are fundamentally opposed from stripping citizenship from those that are dual nationals who commit acts of terrorism. They actually came out and said they were going to oppose this bill before hearing from a single witness. I can tell you that yesterday in committee, this was not a debate. This was a filibuster by the NDP. We know, as a government, the Conservatives recognize how essential this measures in this bill are to national security and the protection of Canadians, and we will get this legislation passed with or without the NDP.
But, okay, aside from bashing the NDP on this, it's not just the NDP that is expressing concerns about this bill. So would it not lend more legitimacy to the bill if there were more meetings, especially within the deadline that you've given?
We have, as I said, eight meetings are going to be held in the evenings. This is something that we offered to the opposition parties in negotiations. It was clear that they were not willing to move on the number of meetings that they wanted. It was not realistic. Canadians would not expect that we would continue hearings on this particular piece of legislation. We have a slate of expert witnesses coming in. We want to hear from those that can add to the conversation, can answer the questions of the members of the committee. This is essential to move on with this legislation. As you know, we would like to see better protection, better security in place before the House rises in the summer. It is essential that we get on with this bill. And what we saw this week from the opposition party was a filibuster with every tactic possible to delay this legislation.
Well, it's not really delaying the legislation when they agree to the deadline that the government has given for ending the study on this.
As I said, we are bringing in more than 50 expert witnesses. This is going to result in actually 9 meetings in total, including the one that I indicated with both the Ministers of Public Safety and the Minister of Justice and officials. So there will be plenty of time to ask the questions. You know, some of the arguments that we heard from the NDP was that they wanted to have less people per panels, that they didn't have time to ask questions. That was absolutely false.
Okay, but that, I mean, you had said that they were trying to delay this bill, but they actually agreed to the timeline that your government is giving on the study for this bill.
As I said, we were very accommodating. We negotiated with them. There was no movement at all on the opposite side. The point that we're trying to make here is we have heard so many stories in the news. You just have to turn on the 6 o'clock news. You have to listen to the radio. We've had attacks, recent attacks in Copenhagen. We saw what happened in Paris. We saw what is going on in Australia. We had attacks right here on Parliament Hill in our capital on October the 22nd. The time that we were in committee this week with the NDP filibustering and trying to delay this bill so we could not start hearing from witnesses the next sitting committee day, we learned of 7 individuals from Canada who had traveled again overseas to join ISIL.
What's the problem with additional oversight as powers are expanded?
Well, our government has been very clear. We believe that third-party, independent, expert, and non-political oversight is the best method to ensure that we don't have any political intervention in the process of our security agencies. Many would agree to that particular statement. With the expanded measures that our Canadian security agencies will have, there is actually a requirement for judicial review and oversight. What that means is for anything that CSIS has the capability intervene, to disrupt a threat, they will actually have to go before a court, they will have to speak to a judge, they will have to provide the evidence, and they will have to have a warrant to be able to carry out that activity. This is common, as you know, law enforcement agencies do this. Warrants are required for any type of investigation, such as entering a premise, wiretaps, and so on. The measures in this bill are common sense. Just this week, we heard of one of the stories of an individual, a young woman who had traveled overseas, joined ISIL, the family came home, she was gone, bags were packed. The family didn't understand why CSIS, our Canadian Security Intelligence Service, could not give them more information, could not show them emails, could not, speak to them and ask them to intervene. The problem that we have right now is that our Canadian Security Intelligence Service is strictly information gathering. Its mandate does not permit them to intervene.
But
its mandate does not allow them to ask a family member to intervene.
But they can ask the RCMP. They can ask the RCMP to intervene, which didn't happen in that case. And it's not exactly what I was discussing with you, but I'll ask you now. Why didn't they refer that to the RCMP, which they have the ability to do, and they have done in the past in many other circumstances, to stop that from happening?
I can't really comment on a specific whether the RCP was carrying on an investigation or whether information was passed. But CSIS, again, is the information gathering agency. That is its current mandate. So it is the one that gathers information. When there is enough information to suspect that someone is going to buy a ticket, a plane ticket, for example, this is just an example, buy a plane ticket, that information, when they have enough evidence, I'm sure would be passed over to the RCMP. But in certain circumstances, they are gathering the information. There may not be an indication at this particular point that someone is actually going to carry out, that they're going to carry out a threat, they're going to commit a terrorist activity, they're going to travel overseas, but they're concerned. And that is why they need to be able to have expanded powers in to disrupt threats, to disrupt travel of people that may choose to be joining ISIL.
Back to the issue of oversight. There was a letter written by academics, legal scholars, former Supreme Court justices, saying that they believe that there should be more oversight than what the bill is calling for. Do you believe that their concerns are not valid?
Well, as I said, we'll be hearing from expert witnesses. We have over 50 slated to come in and speak before the committee, but our government's been very clear. We believe that independent, third-party, expert, non-political oversight is a far better method than what is being proposed by the opposition party. We also have included measures in this particular bill, as I indicated, the require for judicial review and authorization prior to activities that CSIS may partake in, as well as additional reporting requirements that the Security Intelligence Review Committee, that actually does the review and oversees the activities of CSIS, they actually have expanded requirements where they have to provide more information, do more investigation, and all of that is reported back to Parliament.
So you don't like the opposition's proposal, but are you willing to entertain another proposal possibly to increase oversight if you hear from those experts?
Well, again, we've been very clear on this, but we are looking forward to witness testimony. Of course, we'll be taking everything into consideration. That's what committees do. I'm just relieved that we're able to get past the filibuster this week, that we're able to actually start hearing from testimony, hearing from witnesses at the next committee meeting. This is absolutely one of the most important bills in this Parliament session. Obviously, the number one priority of this government is national security and the safety of our citizens. And the changes that are proposed in this common sense bill are just that. They're common sense. Most Canadians think that these things are already being done and would be shocked to find out that they're not.
Just two more quick questions for you. Why no sunset clause? Your Justice Minister, Peter McKay, argued for that back in 2001 after September 11th when the Liberals were bringing in new new legislation on terrorism, and specifically on the issue of preventative detentions. He wanted to see a sunset clause. So why is that not an option in your new legislation?
Well, first of all, I haven't seen any of the amendments that may have been put forward or that are being talked about from the opposition parties. Normally, we don't see amendments or, you know, requests to change the legislation until, you know, after the committee has heard from testimony. So, but with respect to that, governments, any government is able to go back and review legislation at any point it so desires. But again, I've yet to see any type of amendment or request for changes to this from any of the opposition parties.
But I mean, but my question was more about why didn't the government include sunset clauses when it was an issue that that even your current Justice Minister, Peter McKay, was calling for back in 2001.
Again, any government has the ability to go back and review legislation. I've been here since 2011. I can tell you that I've reviewed a lot of legislation. So as things change and requirements change, legislation is looked at. As you know, terrorism is not something that is static. It's ever-evolving. The measures that we're bringing forward in C-51 reflect that change that we're seeing. I think there's not a single Canadian that would disagree with that terrorism has evolved. It's certainly not what it was 10 years ago. I mean, I remember when I heard about, the Toronto 18 and the Via Rail plot. I mean, I think most Canadians were shocked. Now we're hearing about terrorism every day of the week. So it's something that is a serious concern. Our government is taking action on this bill, and I'm hoping that we don't have any more obstruction from the opposition parties.
Last question for you. Who is on the government's witness list? You had made mention of it after the committee meeting that you have your witness list ready to go.
Well, I'm not going to comment on who our specific witnesses are. Obviously, we have submitted a large slate of expert witnesses to the clerk of the committee. Obviously, they're scheduling, they have to make phone calls, they have to make travel arrangements, so we won't know exactly who will be available to come on certain days. But again, I'm looking forward to hearing to each and every one of those more than 50 witnesses. This is the most important piece of legislation this year. We have to see this legislation passed. I'm looking forward to hearing if there's any amendments that are, that would make the legislation better. And I'm just happy that our committee is finally being able to pass the motion to bring this legislation and actually hear witness testimony starting at the next committee.
That was the Parliamentary Secretary to Public Safety, Roxanne James.
You're listening to McLean's on the Hill. Sex is creating quite the controversy in Ontario. How much should our children be taught, and when should they start learning about it? The Ontario government has addressed those questions by introducing a new sexual education curriculum.
It starts in grade 1, where kids will be taught the names of different body parts. In grade 2, they'll be taught no means no. Grade 3, they'll learn about same-sex relationships. Grade 4, it's online safety. Grade 6, masturbation. And by grade 7, they'll be learning about contraception, the different types of sex, and sexting. The Progressive Conservatives are opposed to the changes, and there was a small protest outside Queen's Park of parents who think many of these discussions should be left to the families, not teachers. To delve deeper into the issue, Kara Smusiak of Today's Parents speaks on the phone with Ontario's Education Minister, Liz Sandals, and asks her questions submitted by parents.
A lot of parents say that they feel it should be up to the parents to teach their kids about sex, and that parents should decide when their child is ready. What would you say to those parents?
We want parents to be involved in the conversation, but we also have to pay attention to what the public health data says. So if the public health data says that kids in the junior grades, grades 4 to 6, are going through puberty or beginning to go through puberty, then that's when we need to talk to them about puberty. Part of the reason that we are developing the parent guides and the tip sheets for parents is because we actually want parents to know what their kids are learning, because we think it's we actually think that this is a partnership, that it isn't an either or, that it isn't either the school or the parent. That's not the way it works. We think it's both. So we want the parents to know what's being taught in the school, and then the parent can have the conversation about what are my religious beliefs, what are our cultural traditions, what are our ethical and moral values, so that we actually want the parents to be having that sort of values conversation with their students.
But, you know, the big question that a lot of them are asking is, how is learning about anal sex or oral sex age-appropriate in grade 7?
Okay, so, and this is where some data is important.
Okay.
Is that we know from public health data in Ontario that the teen pregnancy rate has dropped by 50%. At the same time, the rate of sexually transmitted infections that are reported in teenagers has gone up.
Mm-hmm.
We said sort of about 40% to 60%, but if you look at the reported rate of chlamydia infection mm-hmm. in teenagers, it's actually gone up 80%.
Wow.
So the issue, and then the other thing that you probably need as sort of background
mm-hmm.
is that, A, kids are starting to go through puberty when they're 8, 9, 10 years old, which is why we talk about puberty in grade 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they get to grade 9 and 10, about 22, again, this is public health data,
mm-hmm.
about 22% of grade 9 and 10 kids will actually admit that they've had sexual intercourse.
Right.
So grade 7 and 8 becomes this sort of window where the kids are actually mature enough to talk about actual sexual activity, and when you're hopefully going to hit them before they do something stupid.
Right.
And that's it. So when you look at the public health data and you put that all together, many students understand you should avoid having intercourse to avoid having pregnancy.
Right.
And then they turn to other forms of sexual activity, particularly oral sex,
mm-hmm.
and think, well, that's okay, I avoid being pregnant. But what they haven't actually understood is, yeah, but that's how you transmit sexually transmitted infections.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have to give them the whole story.
For sure.
Is that it isn't just about avoiding pregnancy. We also don't want you to get a sexually transmitted infection.
Right. Another, I think another big thing that a lot of parents are concerned with is how this curriculum will impact what's taught in Catholic schools.
And the curriculum is the same in public schools and Catholic schools. This is the Ontario curriculum. In the case of the Catholic schools, they also do a lot of curriculum development through an organization called ICE, which is the Institute for Catholic Education. And that's the Catholic teachers, the Catholic principals, the Catholic directors. It's all the stakeholders in the Catholic education system. The bishops are represented there too. And so we work with ICE on their development of their curriculum. They will make the curriculum, some components of the curriculum, part of their family life course.
Okay.
But the bottom, I think in terms of your parents, that your parents would want to know,
right,
is that the Catholic trustees, the Catholic teachers, the Catholic principals, the Catholic directors have all been quite supportive of the curriculum.
You know, is this going to cut into other areas of learning for, you know, is it going to mean less time on something else in order to make time for this expanded health and physical education curriculum?
No, it shouldn't, because, I mean, we have to take ourselves back to this is a replacement curriculum, so it replaces the 1998 curriculum, so it isn't like we've added a new subject, it just updates the existing curriculum. And there's probably, it isn't that the curriculum has dramatically grown, like the new document's way bigger than the old document, but the new document is bigger because it's got more teacher prompt sort of examples to give teachers more background, more suggestions on how to handle sensitive questions.
For sure.
So it's just that there's more teacher support in it, not necessarily more stuff. The other thing I would say too is that sometimes you'll find that there can be things that can be combined. So, for example, some of the information about healthy, respectful relationships and discussion of healthy, respectful relationships, like that might be combined with something that you're doing in the language course where you're looking at a story. If the story demonstrated relationships, you could teach some of the teaching, you can combine subjects so that teachers often will take, here's some of the expectations for this subject and here's some of the expectations for that subject, and actually just combine it into one lesson plan.
Right.
You can see how you might be able to combine science and some of the information about how does your body change.
That was Kara Smusiak of Today's Parent speaking on the phone with Ontario's Education Minister Liz Sandals about the province's new sex ed curriculum.
Coming up on the show, the Maclean's panel discusses the committee bickering on the anti-terror bill and why Liberal leader Justin Trudeau is suddenly the underdog.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill.
It's now time for the Maclean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by Paul Wells, the political editor for Maclean's, and Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Thanks very much for joining me, guys.
Good to be here.
Okay, C-51, it went to committee, and basically the committee was an interesting show, so to say, with the NDP filibustering and wanting 25 meetings with 100 witnesses to study the bill. The government originally only wanted 3 meetings, but later amended that and went with 8 meetings and 48 witnesses. Paul, do you think that's enough of a review to give an important bill like this?
No, but the government would say if you lay on 600 meetings, they're not going to be a thorough and pondered consideration of the bill. They're going to be, the opposition's going to stack it with as many witnesses as they want who say that the bill's awful. And the government would say, any government would say, and any government pretty soon gets around to saying, you know, about 10 minutes of debate is really all we need, because we know we like it, you know you don't, we know we outnumber you, off we go. And that's frustrating for oppositions and people who like serious conversations. But that's what you get when you keep reelecting Stephen Harper.
Do you think the witness list is going to be something that will add to this debate even more? Is it a chance for the opposition to really take control of the messaging here?
Well, I mean, any discussion of C-51 is a really interesting preview of the sort of legal arguments that will be made if it's challenged in court, as it certainly will be early on in its existence after it's passed. You've got your experts, I've got mine. It's easy to find people who I know right now think it's a good bill, and people who I know right now think it's an awful bill. And the committee process, the committee study of a bill rarely changes anyone's mind about it. And I think that's why the government figures, why bother?
But for a PR strategy anyway, John, we have four former prime ministers who are at the top of the list for the NDP in their witnesses.
No NDP prime minister's on that list either, right? So that's where they roll.
Unless you think Joe Clark is the best NDP prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Paul, you're saying that there'll be people on both sides, and no doubt there will. But I think it's fair to say the preponderance of comment on this has been against it so far, right? The experts, people from the political sphere who've come out on it, it's been, to me, it reminds me a bit of two previous debates, and those would be the census and the Fair Elections Act. Two bills where the Conservatives faced a lot of expert opposition, a lot of spirited sort of principled opposition, and went down two different tracks, right? On the census, they stuck with their position and canceled the long-form census and never really looked back. On the Fair Elections Act, after a point, someone made the calculation, okay, there's too many voices opposed to us here, we've got to bend a bit, and there was compromise. So I still think either of those possibilities is on the table for C-51, depending on how things go in the next month or so.
Does oversight seem like the easy compromise here for the government?
Well, it would be an easy compromise, but it's something that Stephen Harper really doesn't like. I mean, the notion that you would put judgments about national security to parliamentary committees that include the opposition parties, I mean, it gets pretty close to the heart of Stephen Harper's political beliefs to believe that they are illegitimate to consider whether he's right about national security considerations. And so that would be a really tough pill for him to swallow, to give them an entree into any future Conservative government's decisions on things like this.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And everyone, many people have now looked at the history, and there are important people in the Harper government, in the Harper cabinet, who at one time were in favor of that kind of parliamentary oversight. So it's sort of a key thing to remember that this has not always been doctrine, that kind of oversight was unacceptable for some reason.
I mean, this is Harper. Remember when the Ukraine file started to heat up? He's the guy who said, we are sure not going to take opposition politicians with us to Kiev, because they don't believe in democracy in Ukraine, which was ludicrous. But I believe he said it with a straight face, and that he meant it.
All right, now let's take a new focus and look at Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. Paul, you have an article in this week's Maclean's. Basically, you're saying that he's suddenly an underdog. So why are you making that argument?
Our friends at the Abacus polling firm, every couple months they ask people, who do you think is going to win the next election? I mean, so this isn't the purest science of polling. I mean, your guess is literally as good as mine on who's going to win the next election. Almost certainly better. In September, October, the Liberals had a 14-point advantage in expectations of victory in the next election. And in almost a straight line since then, that advantage has vanished. So now a few more respondents expect the Conservatives to win than the Liberals. And you hear that around the Hill, just in casual conversation with people from all political stripes. Well, I figure Harper's going to get reelected, or Harper, conservative minority, you know. And so now, really for the first time in the nearly 2 years he's been the Liberal leader, Justin Trudeau's got a fight on his hands. And now we're going to find out how he handles a fight. And that's a different thing, because one of the things that's been holding the Liberals up in the poll is this sense of inevitability. Well, people are tired of the old government. It's going to be a new government. It's sure not going to be Tom Mulcair. And so once that sense of inevitability goes away, it's also interesting to see whether Trudeau can maintain even the level of support that he's got.
So, John, what do you think is causing this shift?
I think it's cumulative and incremental, right? People keep looking, well, what's going on? They want to see a moment, a policy, something. I don't think that's right. I think it's, you have enough, let's look at it both ways. Stephen Harper has enough good days, and he's had quite a few good days, particularly on foreign files, really going back for quite a long time now, a year and more than a year, he's been mostly out in front of those issues, foreign files, national security files, terrorism files, public safety files. These are all good files for him. And Justin Trudeau has had a lot of lackluster outings, right? I mean, I don't think he looked good on the decision about whether or not Canada should take an active role in Iraq last year. I don't think he's looked particularly strong on C-51. I think Tom Mulcair has outflanked him on that. There are people who disagree with me on that and think the Liberals have done just the perfect thing by striking the middle ground. I don't know. I think they've looked a little bit marginalized. So you take enough days when the Prime Minister looks like he's sure-footed, he knows what he's doing, he's on a file that he wants to be on, enough days where you think, Justin Trudeau just didn't look that hot on that particular topic. And, you know, gradually the polls, I mean, Paul, your point about that being a gradual change over a period of time, gradual but steady change, I think that's illustrative, right? That's sort of what we're seeing.
Yeah. All right, and we'll end off talking about the meeting between Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft, billionaire philanthropist. We talked a lot earlier in the show about Bill Gates, but now we'll take a look at the Prime Minister. John, Canadians might be surprised to hear how engaged the Prime Minister is on foreign aid and development.
He is, and particularly on this maternal and child health focus that he's had now for quite a long time. He put another $3.5 billion into it last spring. That's, I think, really what led to the Bill Gates coming here this week, was that the Canada anteing up again on that file, which is an important file to the Gates Foundation. But more generally, this is an interesting point for the Prime Minister. I think about last fall when he went down to the UN, and many of us, myself included, thought he'd give a barn-burning speech to the Security Council about the Ukraine and Middle Eastern problems, and instead he talked about foreign development and the need for a UN-directed accountability mechanism, and let's all keep an optimistic view of what can be done in world development. This is not the kind of messaging that people associate with the Prime Minister. And the political question I would ask now is, will there come a point where he starts to reap some real political benefits? I think he's sincere about it. I think he wants to do it. I don't think he's doing it for just political reasons. But will he start to, at some point, will there be enough resonance around there? Will there be enough recognition of it that people start going, oh, maybe he's not as one-dimensionally a hawk in foreign policy as we'd imagined?
Yeah. This is an example, a handy reminder that all those boring meetings the Prime Minister sit through that we all ignore, they're actually at those meetings, right? So leading up to the 2010 G8 and G20, the Muskoka summit, we were all distracted, reasonably so, around the rioting and the expensive gazebos there. Mm-hmm. He had meetings on United Nations Millennium Development Goals, and someone said the least progress has been on maternal and child health, and something clicked inside the Prime Minister's head, and he's like, well, that sounds an awful lot like a big domestic priority, which is sort of protecting families. We could export that around the world. It's a file where almost literally each new dollar spent makes a concrete difference. So fairly modest investments can have measurable impact. And Harper saw no downside. And since then, including when all of us have been looking at something else, Harper has been running with this file. So now heading on 5 years. And he's got this relationship with Bill and Melinda Gates, which is starting to be really a striking feature of his prime ministership. They really like working with this guy.
All right. Thanks very much, guys. Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, Maclean's Political Editor Paul Wells, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.